One of the stories had to do with, at that point, I was in a gay men's support group that a psychologist had in Hollywood. And the first night that I joined this group, the group was arguing. One person thought that drag was fine, and this other guy thought that it was just, you know, anti-gender, and was completely upset. And I had never been in drag. I initially got uncomfortable by the conversation, and then finally just blurted out my first night. I said, I don't understand what the big deal is, that you want to have a drag party and you want everyone in the group to come in drag. Really, you know, in the importance of everything in the world, I don't think that's a big request. So we decided we would have this, one of our meetings was going to be at this guy's house over in Hollywood, and we were all going to come and drag and have our therapy group and drag. So I went out and bought a big, huge blonde Diana Ross wig and made a dress. It ended up being much, much bigger than I thought, this thing of putting on the opposite gender's apparel. The first night I put on my wig, and my fear was I was going to be so beautiful that I would be mistaken for a woman. And I put on all of this stuff and looked in the mirror, and I was not beautiful. And it was devastating to see that I wasn't very beautiful, and that it had turned out that to actually do this thing of putting on women's clothing was really huge for my little identity. My little identity could hardly handle that. That was 6 o'clock at night, and I went to bed at 6:30 that night and slept for something like 16 hours. It was so monumental. Later got more comfortable and went downstairs. Kelly, I told Kelly about it, and she lived on the floor below me, and she wanted to see me. So I went downstairs, and I put on my dress and my wig, and she said, oh, the dress is all wrong. And so at some point, I was in this little old lady's apartment. She was 80-something. And I was standing there in my blonde Diana Ross wig and one of her big, huge, blue-flowered beach muumuus and some big shell earrings. And, you know, I was like, I don't know how I got here. I don't know how I got here in this little old lady's apartment in her clothes. And she said, so what are you doing? Are you getting dressed up? I want to see your makeup before you go. I went, oh, no, I'm not driving from Venice Beach all the way to Hollywood in drag. You know, I will get ready there at this guy's house. And she was like, she said, no. She said, I think you should get dressed upstairs. I think she could walk down, find your car in the parking lot, and drive across town as proud as anybody. And don't let anybody say anything to you. And go to that party. And I was, that is not what I did. You know, I drove across town and got dressed at the party. But that's who she was. She was a great mentor of feistiness. Just gained a lot from her. So that was one of the stories that got woven into this 40-minute dance. What was interesting about it was when I came back to New York, I didn't know how. I didn't write. I didn't speak on stage. So I extemporaneously told my stories and made the dance. And the closer we got to the performance, because I had never had a performance in New York. I had made one, like, I think 12-minute dance when I lived in Los Angeles, and that was the extent of my choreography / performance creativity. So the closer we got to the performance, the more I stuttered and and ahed and paused and forgot what I was saying. And then I would say maybe 2.5 to 3 weeks out from the performance, I really panicked and just went, you know, this is my New York debut as a maker, and I'm just going to lay a big, huge egg. So I wrote down every word of the story. And then because I was a mover, I put every word of the story to movement. I put every word of the story to movement. And then because I was so terrified, then when the audience came in, I remember they sat down, and I was just going, and I told all the story that went with us. My words just came out of my mouth because I'd practiced so much and went with all that movement. And I just, it was like being in a dream, and the audience was roaring, and all I was doing was remembering the movement, but my mouth was working with the gestures. And it was really successful. And I thought I had discovered this gigantic thing. But later, when I came to VCU and was teaching Movement for Actors, the acting teacher says that that's what everybody does. You marry the words that you're going to speak in the play to blocking and movement and gesture. And I was like, well, but I discovered it too. So
you've done more work since then, I know, here in choreographing dances. When did you first make a dance for, not the one in L.A., but otherwise, did you start that in New York?
That first piece I started in New York, the choreography came when I moved down here. That first concert that I did up in New York that had the Opal Kelly stories in the movement, I split with a woman friend of mine, we split the concert. What would happen in New York, though, was you would put together something with somebody, it would be successful or not successful, and then for me, I would have to then spend the next year as a waitron paying off my MasterCard so I could make another piece or have another concert up there. So when I came down here in 84 as the guest artist, I found that, you know, there were lots of people who wanted to be involved, either as dancers or as audience. There was space to rehearse in that wasn't $15 an hour, like New York. And I reluctantly took this job down here. I thought it was going to be a great compromise, leaving New York. I thought things were going well up there. But in fact, it was not a compromise at all. It was the beginning of the flowering of an incredibly productive, rich part of my career. Because I came down here and I didn't have to worry about the finances of it. And I wasn't doing anything else but teaching dance. And I could make dance there in the same place where I taught. So then the choreography, all these ideas that I had had for years just poured out of me. And I learned a lot. I was a late starter. I also had some real physical limitations as a dancer. And I just kept worshiping at the altar of dance, waiting to get good enough so that I could eventually make something. So then eventually, at like 33 or 34, I decided that time was getting short and that if I was going to make something, I should make it. So then here at VCU, I just started making lots of pieces. The thing that was surprising was that my commercial art and my visual process of making, which had been from like 5 years old through college, was an incredible basis for structuring and thinking organizationally, and that it transferred over to choreography. I don't know how it did, but it did, and I felt like I was able to do some fairly good pieces off the bat because of my visual arts background. And I feel like that's something that I bring to the choreography arena that other choreographers don't have. And I feel really fortunate that that was my background, the visual arts.
What dancers or choreographers did you admire whose work also fit into yours?
I really like Jane Comfort's work as movement and text. I think there are amazing choreographers who they are kinesthetically driven. They are movement vocabulary driven. I thought Bella's work, the best of her work, could be staggeringly beautiful. And she had a vocabulary like nobody else. I thought Merce Cunningham is a genius. His capacity for invention seems bottomless.
Now, when he was here a few years ago, and he and the chair did a little thing together that fascinating.
No, I was very moved by that. Martha Graham, I thought a completely different idiom, but she was visually incredibly strong.
Now, do you feel that you have put all these things together and found your own vocabulary and choreography now as strongly as you found your own vocabulary in the monologues?
I think it's a process, and I think I've become more and more who I am as my vocabulary gets smaller and smaller. That the aging process has a way of honing everything down, especially for movement.
I was talking to somebody just this weekend who said that he remembered some artist said once upon a time, may have been Red Grooms, that when he was young, when he was in the studio, there were about 50 other people there with him. As he got a little older, maybe 25. When he got really old, it was just himself there, that the voices of other influences had stopped. Are you finding that that's...
I have a list, you know, I write in my journals, and I have a list that I made maybe 18 months ago. It was just like, these are me. These pieces and these themes and how I want to do them are totally me, and I want them done before I'm done choreographing. Two of those pieces are in the September concert.
Which ones are those?
They're both the new pieces. Another three of them, really, that were on this initial list. But the two new pieces are on that list, and one of them is based on the work of Caravaggio, his life and his work. Just read this book called M. I can't remember the author, and it was read it like two summers ago, and it was little bits and snippets from this pope writing to this bishop about Caravaggio and what they're going to do with him. He was this really dark, wild, violent person and getting into trouble. And it was a very dry read to begin with, but somewhere about page 60, it started to unfold like a murder mystery to me. And the more I read, the more I realized that everything is the same. And that, you know, he was at the end of the 1500s. You know, he was fighting for survival as an artist, and who's a patron and who supports him and who doesn't, and where does that come from? He was fighting for his identity as a gay person, and he was a violent person in a violent time. So nothing's changed at all. So as I was reading this book, I just felt like these visual images of some kind of moving tableau began to unfold, and I just went, I want that done. I feel like I don't think I have been mature enough to have ever been able to address this issue before, but now I feel like I am, and if I'm much more mature, I'm not going to be able to. So that's on the list, and that's going to be seen in September. And then this other new piece is based on, it's inspired by two things, a short story by Tennessee Williams and the work of the painter Paul Cadmus. And I also think it's completely different. The Caravaggio piece is really dark and is violent, and I think is totally visual in its impact. This other piece is narrative. It's sort of like the short story. It's the story of a gay man and a straight woman who meet in a bar and realize that working as a team, they do much better in the meeting men category than they do as working as a solo.
What's the title of the story?
Two on a Party. And then I merged that with, or kind of inspirationally married that to Paul Cadmus's The Fleet's Inn and Sailors and Floozies. So there are two sailors in this piece. And it's bawdy and I think very funny. Only one person has seen it, but she laughed a lot when she was watching it. Has music that's inspired by the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And it's sort of like a big drunken party. Those two pieces were two that were on my list. And I feel really good that I did them. I feel they both made me incredibly nervous to begin and to be in process with. Less this one than the other one, but the Caravaggio piece, I feel like I was the most insecure as a maker that I have been in years and years in the process. I was just like, I don't know what this is. This seems really dark. And I've learned that if I'm really nervous, that generally makes, I know I'm on a good path, but this was the most insecure I got to. So it was like it was a difficult process, but I think what came out of it, I'm not totally done yet, but I feel like the draft of it, I go, oh, that's what I saw.